Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hi, everybody. It's me, Justin Robert Young.
Brian Brushwood.
That's right. It's me, too. And I was for real taking a drink. I wasn't just faking it so that Andrew would be disappointed when I could talk.
I assumed it was a bit because after I say Justin's name, I usually say your name. And you figured that out. You cracked that code. And special guest here, graphic designer, brand specialist, and now author, JF Dubow.
I'm holding up a glass to feel like I'm part of the gang.
You are part of the gang because you have written the book The Life Engineered, which is an official Sword and Laser selection.
Congratulations.
Brand new out there. Everybody can get this. It's a tale of genetic engineering, of future conflict.
No
Boston Cop takes place in, what, the fourth millennia? I think so.
Something like that, yeah.
So, what's that?
Something like that, except there's no genetic engineering.
I threw that in there. I wanted to give it a little bit of a boost.
I'll look into it for a sequel, though.
No, just a pro tip out there. No, so JF is here. We're going to have him give us the rundown on the story in Weird Things. That's going to be our last segment. He's going to tell us about this, where the idea came from, what excites him about sci-fi, and what inspired him for that. And then in After Things, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the process of how he got into writing, what made him decide to finally just take the leap, put something out there for everybody else to see, working with becoming a selection of the Sword and Laser podcast, working with Ink Shares and all that. So that'll be our After Things podcast. But here we're going to talk about the weird.
Is there going to be a time, like maybe 5 minutes, when I can try to convert you anti-robot people to be more pro-robot? Because, I mean, I love the Weird Things podcast. I've been listening to you guys for years, but every time you guys talk about the impending robo-apocalypse, it rubs me the wrong way.
I'm at peace with it. Look, the robots are superiors, and they're going to live, thrive, and survive through the stars. We're going to be like Remora, just latching on, riding their coattails throughout the universe.
I'm in favor of that part. And I'm not trying to co-op the show or anything about that, but I agree, we're going to be like latching on as parasites. But I think it'll be more of a Saturday morning cartoon, kind of like the robots and us will get along. They'll just be so much better than us.
I mean, we're going to be robots' dogs, is what it is. They're going to take real good care of us.
All right, I don't want to break up the robot love fest here, but like,
see, this is exactly what I'm talking about.
Well, hold on, Jean-François, Let me clarify here. Are we talking about robots or are we talking about AI? Because I don't feel like we here on the Weird Things podcast have been negative on either necessarily, beyond understanding that they, AI specifically, will be something that will be very, very, very powerful, more powerful than we can understand right now at this point in history.
No, I agree with that, but there's because maybe it's part of me trying to promote my book. There's been this assumption that Skynet is coming and is AI will destroy us.
It's not an assumption. It is one potentiality. And that's the point, is that it is a potentiality with such scary life-ending implications to say, no, I don't think it'll go that way, is perhaps not exactly the most proactive approach.
Well, and also,
I was saying, like, when people like, you know, Sergey Brin, Larry Page, Elon Musk, some of the big people putting tons of money into developing AI, absolute champions of AI, people who are very much champions of AI, who know a hell of a lot more about it than I do, when they're saying, yeah, it's exciting, but you know what? There's this really scary possibility that X could happen. I'm like, it's not like there are a bunch of weird people on the fringe who are like anti-AI saying this. These are advocates of it saying, we need to worry about that. And that's what makes me go, oh, yeah, that's a good thing. And I you know, in everything I read, I mean, I love the idea that they're going to take us for the long and they'll make us our pets. But you know, the idea, but the for me, the thing that I was aware of is the gulf between us and them, and we keep imagining them as just these bigger versions of us or smarter versions of us, but there's so many things and aspects to a human personality that you would not necessarily have in that. There's so many aspects to even within hominids, you know, some hominids succeeded, others didn't. You look at 2% of the population sociopath, and they consistently we keep doing that. And you know, I'm concerned. I have concerns.
I agree with the concern. This is why, like, I like how Elon Musk's approach with the whole OpenAI initiative, mm-hmm. which at first made me think, oh, old people afraid of robots, which really feels weird when you think about Elon Musk, because he seems to be, he's completely the opposite. Like, he's in favor of progress. But I like the OpenAI initiative because at first it, the way the articles that came up to sort of announce it, to talk about it, were, oh, you know, Elon Musk has initiative to protect us from Skynet or whatever. Where in fact, when you read the mission description, it's very much more like, hey, if AI is going to happen, let's make it happen. Let's make it happen faster, but let's make it happen in a controlled, steady kind of way. And this is the kind of stuff that I am more in favor of seeing. But there's a lot of like fear about AI that is kind of based on a lot of anthropocentric assumptions about how artificial intelligence is going to develop. And anyways, and I know like a lot of the times that you guys speak about AI and like, oh, like I'm ready to be
that we tend to sort of think of them in some way magnifying human qualities, and the anthropocentric view is that, oh, they're going to be like these, they're going to be territorial and want to conquer us like us. And I've always said, like, yeah, it's not going to be, they're not going to be smarter primates. They're going to be another thing, another. And it also comes to the other side where we assume, well, they're going to be benign and like us or love us. Why do they have to love or like us? Why do they even need to? Why would they? And there are a lot of scenarios where it becomes super powerful before it develops those higher level functions and can have the ability to wipe us out before it stops and says, ah, you know, maybe they would be good. You know, that's the you know, one of the many concerns is that we have this, we either imagine them as the best of us or the worst of us. I imagine that they very early stages are going to be nothing like us, but super capable.
No, so, I completely agree with that.
JF, what would you consider to be whenever, in either on this podcast or in general, are for you the most frustrating elements of people talking about AI?
My biggest concern is when people are jump over on the whole AI thing being a threat by assuming that AI, very much the same thing that Andrew was just saying, basically the people tend to assume that AI are going to be human plus when they're actually going to be something completely tangential. They're one of the things I like to imagine, just, you know, for funsies, philosophically, is like we tend to think that they're going to have the same emotions as us. They're going to have envy, they're going to have hatred, they're going to have love, jealousy, when I like to muse that they're probably not going to have the same emotions. They might even have emotions that we cannot even have, don't even have words for, and can't understand, because they're going to develop in a way that nothing else has developed in the past.
And it's funny, it's almost as though baked into the idea of any kind of AI taking over humanity or the planet Earth or whatever, it's as though it's just obvious that an artificially intelligent being would have a desire for self-preservation, that would be one of its motivations. And I don't know that any of the programmers are going to go out of their way to build that in. We have an extremely strong desire to stay alive, you know, honed by millions of years of evolution. I don't know that that'll be baked into an AI at all. I mean, outside of maybe a convenient, hey, stop erasing yourself kind of a thing.
But that gets into Nick Bostrom's paperclip argument, and the idea that it's not a matter of its primary function is to do that. But if you say, hey, give it a thing to solve, let's say make paperclips, and you have an extremely capable AI that says, oh, I'm supposed to make paperclips. Okay. And it proceeds to, you know, take over nuclear defense networks. I'm just throwing this out there. It destroys humanity so it can take every single piece of metal material that it has to produce paperclips, because this is the way to produce the most paperclips. This is the function I need to do. And obviously we'd say, well, we wouldn't program it to be that dumb or to do it that way, but it's how do you know what to do? How do you know how to put those limitations in there? How do you do this? Because if you did, you have certain systems right now, you know, if you programmed it, an airplane to get from point A to point B as fast as you possibly could without regard for the passengers on board, it would say like, oh, well, I can operate in I can go up above the ceiling limit of normal flight height. I don't need to pressurize the cabins. I don't need to do all this, and I will maximize my route. No human being will survive that, but it will do the thing that it needs to do.
It will satisfy, yeah. And there are some great examples in that book, Superintelligence, where, you know, you get these perverse consequences. What I think is fascinating is, like, the very moment an AI gets only slightly smarter than humans, it's sort of all the way over at that point. And what I enjoyed was some of the thought experiments he had of, like, how do you grow an intelligence in a safe environment where you get it, what, you know, 70% of humanity's intelligence, then up it to 80. And then you start baking into it all these things that limit it from wanting to break free of constraints and to fulfill its programming on its own. There was a lot that I liked about Superintelligence, the book, but ultimately I did feel like it was a lot of hand-wringing about some made-up scenarios that by the very nature of them, none of us are smart enough to know how a smarter than human intelligence will be created. And therefore, it kind of turned down the volume of the panic for me in that regard. But again, I mean, I assume that's an indication that I'm just not smart enough to appreciate the book entirely.
I'm beginning to read Superintelligence. I'm very curious because I heard about it on this very program, and I was wondering about that whole hand-wringing thing. I like to see what the arguments are to be afraid of AI just so I can sort of bash my head against them. But what? It's because a lot of things, like if you look at the paperclip thing, paperclip maximizer idea, a lot of these things assume, and they're great thought experiments, and I'm glad that we're having them. And that's a lot of why I love sci-fi, because they make us think of these things. But a lot of it assumes a certain conceit that is, in effect, kind of ridiculous. And again, like Andrew hints at it, why would we program a super intelligent computer that's also super dumb enough not to realize, you know, consequences?
But it's
like,
dumb by our definition. The thing is, exactly. We say that the unintended consequences are consequences we don't want, but it's not dumb, and it's dumb towards our intent. But he gets into, you know, the whole things of, like, if, you know, an example we brought up before is, you say, okay, here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna say, like, we don't do anything that won't make me happy. And then it says, oh, well, you know, I can carve your brain out of your head, and then I can just take your pleasure neurons and put them on a petri dish, and then I can just constantly trigger them with happiness. Won't that be great?
You know? Yeah, and technically, yeah, you're incredibly ecstatically happy. And to be honest, I think some version of that.
Can we do that? Because that doesn't sound that terrible.
And to be honest, that's where I'm at. Like I don't have a panic or a fear about the robots taking over. I feel like that's, at some point it'll happen. I mean, I can't wrap my mind around a world where that doesn't eventually happen.
They just carve out purely your pleasure center, no memory, everything else like that, and throw it in a petri dish and just constantly stimulate it with pleasure.
No. I mean, like 1,000 years from now, there will only be echoes of what we think of as humanity. I think it'll all be robots 1,000 years.
But that's a very reduced form of it. That's stripping away your memory, your concept of identity and being. I'm just saying is that there's this. I am a you know, Homo sapien plus, you know, I've been into singularity stuff. I've been into all of this sort of stuff, you know, extropianism, all that. I mean, I've been a big fan of this stuff, you know, from reading, you know, Engines of Creation by Eric Drexler. I'm a guy that's like, I'm excited. I'm this. And it's awesome. But I'm also a guy that's like, yeah. And having spent so much time in this headspace and going, well, how does this thing go? You know, we're used to having technology and everything driven by human ambitions, and we can look and say, okay, you have, you know, wisdom of the crowds mentality and how things work out really well, market systems, things like that. But when you have another driving force in there that has a totally separate ambition, that's what all of a sudden, like, oh, that's the disruptive factor, and that's the thing that makes me go, well, you know, let's be mindful of this stuff.
Yes, absolutely. In the short term, in the visceral, I want to protect my children kind of way, all of that, 100% true. But on the flip side, I kind of feel like the idea of preserving humanity in evolutionary terms makes about as much sense as preserving Homo erectus. Like, are we all shedding tears that Homo erectus ain't around to kick around anymore?
Yeah, but we carry a lot of Homo erectus. There's a significant, you know, we share 96%, 97% of our genes with Homo erectus. That's a sufficient, pretty high percentage of Homo erectus is talking right now. And there was somebody in the chat room who said, clearly you guys are not programmers. Please tell us where we're astray on this, because, you know, and I would say that probably next
spoken
to nobody out
like
there
spoken like a true programmer.
Yeah, and I'm going to guess that only a tiny, if any, fraction of our audience is actually a machine learning programmer, too, which...
Now, is he talking programmer in the sense of someone programming today, or programmer like characters from Tron? Because there's a massive difference there too.
Let's not overreact to one comment.
No, I brought up the robot thing, and I thought it would be like a 5 minute like, oh, aren't robots cool? And I mean, I can definitely have this discussion for next few hours if you guys want, because there's a different approach also, because we're a lot of what we're talking about machines making these very, very linear decisions about, oh, you know, this is the goal, this is the swiftest and most efficient way to get to the goal, also kind of assume certain things about machine intelligence that I'm not exactly sure will develop. But again, going back to the idea, like, even if there's a 1% chance that it goes that way, is it worth worrying about? This is going to be a super long discussion. I feel like I just walked into the show, pissed in a corner to establish my territory.
No. What you did was you walked in and asked one of the most poignant, like, cuts right to our id, our ego, you know, of like we care deeply about this question. And you're like, oh, you want to talk about that? We can talk about that all day. Let's go.
Oh, dude, that robots. And I almost brought up space elevators just to stir the pot, but... My concern obviously is robots, because I have a very, very optimistic view of robots in the future, and I don't know why I had this built in sort of fear that you guys weren't were into robots, but in a more negative Terminator sort of point of view. Well,
I don't think that we've ever had that. In fact, I mean, I know going back even before this podcast started, you know, but my conversations with Andrew have always centered around the idea that that there's certainly a very careful eye we should have on it, and us understanding what the evolution of AI is something that we should continue to keep our finger on the pulse of. But in general, there's no reason, I think, from what you've said, JF, that no reason to assume that these anthropomorphic concepts will necessarily translate. I mean, but when we say that AI will be the son or daughter of humanity, I think we think of it literally like a son or a daughter that inherits traits, right? As opposed to this whole nother concept, which I think we've all talked about on this podcast, is something that's very, very interesting and probably unknowable from this point.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
Jeff, no, this is exactly why the show exists, and it's great to have somebody who is writing and creating in that space, you know, of where is this going to go, who's written a story that deals heavily with this, because this is what the show's about, you know, and you're somebody who's obviously spent a tremendous amount of time thinking about that, and so please.
Yeah, because I started my initial thought process about, like, robots was because of, like, I wanted to write that apocalyptic story, and just the more I thought about it, the more I thought it became more and more unlikely that would be essentially the scenario that would unfold, because of the points that you were making about how robots would think differently and not necessarily have the same motivations. And the more I thought mostly about the motivation thing, this is where I kind of started thinking about the whole idea of a robot apocalypse in terms more of criminology approach. Mm-hmm. Like, I was trying to find motive, opportunity. Like, motive is it's unknowable whether they would have a motive to destroy humanity. Opportunity is something that we would need to sort of program or provide to them anyways. So there's a lot of things that just didn't jive as far as robot apocalypse. And that's when I kind of switched to loving the robots and wanting to share that love of the robots.
You know, that was actually what happened when Michael Crichton, of course, you know, he's made his bones by figuring out disaster scenarios of various, you know, trendy technological trends. But he originally started researching because he wanted to write a disaster novel in which climate change killed everyone. But then the more he did, he was just like, I can't find any way to kill a lot of people with climate change. And now, obviously, in the 10 years since he wrote that book in his passing, a lot of the science has changed. But certainly That seems to be an experience a number of authors go through.
I think, my problem with robo or AI apocalypse scenarios is that they are, they just assume just a smarter, more evil sort of person, and then it turns into a traditional land war, and it's like, no, I mean, if they're that smart, it's not, we're all not going to wake up one day, it's not going to be, fought in any, if that were the case. And Bostrom gets into some really crazy sort of scary things, like disseminating like little needle sized things around the world with nerve gas agents and stuff, and how, you have such a super advanced, the method of our demise is beyond our comprehension, and that's, if it were to happen. And again, I am a person who believes that AI is going to be a very positive and big part of our future. There's no future where AI isn't our future. I believe that fervently. And my position is that all the more for us to understand the potentialities. And there was a scare that turned out to be unproven. I mean, false, but when we had Stuxnet was the worm that was designed to infect the Iranian centrifuges and cause them to spin apart as they were trying to enrich, to make nuclear weapons. And we don't know where it came from, although probably Americans and Israeli programmers engineered this thing. And this was causing catastrophic damage to their program. And there was rumors that Stuxnet had gone wild and was now infecting other systems other than it was intended to. And I think that this was not proven to be true, but that was... But that could have happened had it been designed to do that. And as we start developing much more intelligent, destructive systems, worms into that effect, as we see that, like, man, there's a lot of things that that little smart AI can do a lot of damage, and it doesn't have to have of its own volition decide that it's going to do these things. It just has to do what it's supposed to do. And Stuxnet's things like, here's a system that meets this criteria. I'm going to go in there and I'm going to infect it, and I'm going to defeat all of its security protocols and do what I'm supposed to do because that's what I do. And then it does that. And then, in a different situation, you could have a very scary outcome.
Nutty side jag here. One of the big bits of science news was, of course, we measured gravitational waves for the first time, right? And one of the big talking points was that you can theoretically encode information in gravity waves. And the mere fact of, would it be possible I guess, unfortunately, I've just realized I'm describing the plot of Species, basically. But like, can you...
And Contact.
Can you encode in a gravitational wave a virus? I guess you would have to take an educated gamble about what kind of computational power systems to be infected would have and so on.
Yeah, I think the problem with that is that to sort of transmit your virus, you need two neutron stars that you wave next to each other in a specific pattern to create your code. That seems like a lot of work to me.
Yeah, well, it would, but it'd be very low bandwidth. But yes, technically yes.
And also, it's incredibly impractical. But if we're going to play the game of Michio Kaku's supposition of type 1, type 2, type 3 civilizations, if we're going to propose a civilization that can create Dyson spheres and move planets and stars around for their own amusement, why not if they're smart enough?
Yeah, I absolutely. There's one of the scenarios that Nick Bostrom talks about, which was interesting, was you have an AI sitting in a lab and it wants to get out of the lab. And it can now go to one of these mail order DNA companies where they will create a DNA strand according to what you say. Build a little DNA protein machine, send the instructions out to this thing, and it gets a test tube, hire somebody on Craigslist to say, hey, put this thing next to a speaker, and connect it to this channel, and then using sound vibrations, program it. And he comes up with a very realistic way using present technology. If you had the right design, you could do this thing.
Well, the scary part is, of course, that's as good as a human level intelligence was able to make in a book about the subject. And if you're supposing that the AI is, again, only slightly smarter than humans, then by definition, it's an unknowable plan that they have in order to execute their next level.
That's the thing that worries me is that we can, the best scenario we come up with is going to be the best scenario that a human-level AI comes up with. And then a week later, as it's developed and be developed a more efficient algorithm and increases by a factor of 10, it's you know, they're I love studying super fringe technologies like Pico technology, the idea of when you're trying to build things inside in using individual, not building them out of atoms, but using them out of the elements that make up atoms, using, you know, getting into that. And there's ideas about quark technology and trying to get into that area. And so one of my problems is sort of like the way we measure these sort of galactic scales is we start defining it by how big of a level they look work on, where the more interesting area and the more likely, in my opinion, is how smaller and finite they're able to do when they're able to put an entire supercomputer inside of one individual atom. And then moving to another inside of an atom, which is something that sounds theoretically, but people have done math on that and said, well, if you can manipulate quarks and these things, you can actually start to create these functions. That's what's fascinating to me, is that we go in this totally different direction than we even can conceive of.
It's funny because once you get to the level where you posit the ability to, you know, again, create Dyson spheres and harness all the energy in a star and move them around, once you hit that level, it you start to factor in the time limit, the impending heat death of the universe, the point at which everything becomes so diffuse that there's no matter left to convert into energy. And I don't know, there's like this fatalism that comes over me. It's like, yeah, we could do all that. Why? What's the matter? In a blink of an eye, in celestial terms, we're all going to be, you know, just cold void here.
Well, the answer actually is super simple to that, is why try to be the kind of species that can eventually control things on a celestial level and basically, like you say, move planets, create Dyson spheres to avoid that quote-unquote inevitable end? I mean, the name itself says it's inevitable, but what is impossible now? Like, if you're talking about a civilization that's going to be looking at things in such a fatalistic manner, but has that level of technology, if that's the things that they can do now, they can probably start theorizing what they can do that's even beyond that and start looking at solving that. So I mean,
hold on.
You see where I'm going with that, right?
Well, yes. So if you're at that ability and you recognize that you're inside a cage and the cage is built out of time, you have so much time till the heat death of the universe or whatever, I suppose you could try to because gravitational waves, and forgive me, I'm way outside my depth here, but as I understand, one of the posits of string theory is that we live on a brain, B-R-A-N-E, a membrane, that possibly at some point collided with another brain, creating the Big Bang or whatever, but we're trapped within our dimensions. Gravity, and again, I hope I'm remembering this right, theoretically can go between brains, from one brain to another. And if gravitational waves can carry information, theoretically, you could encode, you know, our the story of our universe in a gravitational wave that blasts out of our universe and into another one. Is that a thing?
Maybe.
Yeah, that's kind of
Brian, beyond, I think that we can all say seems legit.
I am not drunk enough to theorize on that yet. Give me 15 minutes.
We can start to get into is that then you can also start theorizing the idea of like we could build black holes and singularity events and other things, and then we can buy a hell of a lot more time from a relative point of view than the eventual heat death of the universe. And when you start talking about living life digitally, and you know, when you're building quantum computers that can have their own versions of reality, you'd be like, hey guys, listen, we've only got 18 billion years left. Let's all hop inside of this overclocked computer system and give us a trillion years solve this problem. Inception.
My point was essentially like, I don't think there's ever a point where you reach a level of technology where you kind of grow bored with what you can do with it and go, but eventually we're going to die, so whatever, Dyson spheres.
That's fascinating. Imagine a world where the responsible decision as a parent to make, like you're like, I want the best for my children. I want them to have the maximum amount of opportunity. I want them to be able to possibly, you know, keep my legacy going for centuries to come. So as a responsible parent, I'm going to have his brain cut out and logged into this simulator because physical body is not as important. You know, I don't want to be one of these crude primates walking around on the maintenance side of things. I want him to be able to experience life to the fullest, which of course means plugging him into the Matrix.
But how many years do you think we are from when you're having a child, having to make the decision, okay, now that he's born, do I implant him with extra memory or some, you know, hardware to be able to connect? Like, we are going to approach a point at some degree where modifying a child that either genetically or with electronics of some kind of a hybrid of the two is going to be a concern. When do you start making that decision?
I mean, we already are in so many ways. You know, it's like being the parent of three girls. There's a number of enhancements that I spend money to do. It's like I want my kid to get a jump on algebra, so I'm going to download the Dragon Box app, and they think they're playing a video game. They're secretly learning algebra and whatever. In so many ways, I'm essentially downloading a module and installing it in my child's brain.
I think there gets into the idea where I'm all for all kinds of enabling children to kind of live up to having a genetic maximum potential that we know that works well enough in humans. We've had in the last few years exciting developments with the CRISPR technique, Cas9, with precision gene splicing, which we're looking at. We're at that threshold right now where we can eliminate a tremendous number of diseases, which I think we should do and work towards doing that. And it has gene drive, which then they won't pass those diseases on. Then we have to reach that, you know, that idea of like, how much more do we add or influence? You know, is there an advantage of 150 IQ over 130? You know, or do you start to see at certain points when you increase genetic domains, it's more problematic? And I can imagine a scenario where your goal is let people be born healthy as you can, let them mature, and then at a certain point in maturation, you then let them decide what degree that they want to go do that. But, you know, we live in a world where we indoctrinate children very early on into religion, and we put a label on them ahead of time and determine these things for them. My ideal may not be the norm.
Yeah, I was about to say, the moment you were describing that, I was like, man, we're already breaking that rule with religion and politics. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like there's nothing more likely to determine your political affiliation than what your parents' political affiliation was.
Well, let me ask you, what is your children's political affiliation, Brian?
They're hardcore anarcho-capitalist libertarians, and I couldn't be prouder of them. And I'm sure they've decided on their own.
Yeah. You know, right now, my brother and his wife are only a few months away from having their first kid, and they're doing a great podcast, a young family podcast, plug there. But their last episode was them going over vaccinations, right? And just that idea that, you know, there is a conversation on whether at what point you should vaccinate your child, right? Despite the fact that there is no scientific evidence that you shouldn't do it as soon as possible, there is this idea of like, well, let's just wait a little bit. If we don't have to do it now, then maybe we should do it later for fear that something could go wrong. And you got to figure if we're doing that now, you know, there's a sense, a human sense of like, well, you know, maybe we should think about this more for like health and vaccinations, then you got to figure that it'll only continue to compound as we have more profound possible changes for our children.
I can't wait for the cultural debates to start over whether or not we should have people with USB ports implanted young or older.
Well, but I don't think we'll have that particular discussion.
No, USB is probably going to be passed by time.
But like, because the one of the things we're aware of is how fast things develop. So last summer, you know, scientists said they had developed the first neural lace. And neural laces are things that are frequently in the EM Bank stories, which is this idea of this sort of lattice over your brain, which makes it very easy to have an interface with computers. And so it's slightly invasive, but not too invasive, whatever, but it's still a surgical procedure. This year, some people have announced they've come up with a neural lace protocol neural lace technology. You don't have to open up the head and put it in there. You can like inject it from a different part and it becomes an injectable. We're going to see by the time that it's practical to have a neural lace, you're probably going to be something you take with a nasal inhaler, and then it's going to dissolve when you want to. And so you're not going to be as worried about making this lifetime commitment. It'll be like a piercing, not a tattoo.
Yeah. It's awesome to see us growing beyond my capability of understanding. Like, it's sort of like you ever play a video game and you punch in the God code and you get this really big thrill for about 20 minutes, and then you realize there's no point. It's like I could just crush everyone. And I don't expect that we'll exactly feel that with hacking the body, but I can see, you know, that kind of becoming the new existential quandary that we deal with.
But isn't that, but that's constant for us, right? In fact, when we talk about any of these far-flung future things, I think it's hard for us, in as advanced of a civilization as we are, we're not that far away. When I think as Western civilization, we are still haunted by things like the Dark Ages or the medieval period or the ideas of the fall of Rome or you know the Renaissance rebounding out of that like this idea that things can change rapidly and then stop and then regress, right? We are constantly haunted by that. And let's say for a moment that we are on an uptick that will not in many, 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 many lifetimes for us ever stop, right? That we will continue to evolve and advance and change. And a lot of these will kind of beget their own advancements within themselves. I still think now whenever we think about it, an era that still thinks, oh, you know, this person's leading in a political poll. It's the fall of Rome. Like, we're just obsessed with this idea that we're going to collapse, right? Like, I think it's hard for us to even look in the far future without that tainting it.
Yeah, and I mean, there's some of that fear that was actually, I read an article recently about the fear that even the way we're storing information now, we're looking maybe at losing a lot of it because of the way we're storing it is not as permanent as we think it is. Some studies, what was the article again? Basically, someone figured out that the way sometimes we copy information, there's some information that's lost, and that was mostly noticed in some upgrades of a engineering or architecture software or some of the parameters for a building, even though they thought they had upgraded the files correctly to a newer system, some information loss meant that they couldn't, there was some faults in the new version. And the idea that somehow someone extrapolated that and saying that, oh, maybe, you know, we might be looking at another Dark Ages of information. And this is kind of alarmist point of view that kind of angers me about the way people look at technology.
There certainly is. You get into problems of utility, and I think what is it? Facebook backs up their data on Blu-ray or something to that effect. That they're
some kind of physical media.
Yeah, I heard it's actually Blu-ray because they looked at like the longevity of that, and they realized that has a longer term. And Google has been investing incredibly in there to figure it out. And you know, what is the value of MySpace preserving an account that you or I have not touched in 10 years, and that's a real question because, you know, we're probably never going to go back there, but there might be photos and things up there that might be interesting or useful that maybe I wish I had. But, and these problems, I'm less worried about these problems that as storage becomes radically cheaper and as the cloud becomes much, much cheaper, a lot of the simpler stuff does become easier to store. You know, I have on my iPhone, I have 10,000 photos. I have 10,000 photos in there that as long as I keep my iCloud account, those things are there. You know, if I stop my iCloud account, then yeah, I have to put it in some other physical media, but it's getting to the point that to maintain those photos gets ridiculously cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper to the point that it'll be easier just to leave them on somebody's server somewhere. You know, we're not there yet. And that's not, and that doesn't mean that larger, more complex media is going to be automatically solved, but I'm not as worried. I am worried about things, older media, older films that we haven't been able to save, older computer data that's already locked up in, you know, systems that we have trouble getting to.
There's definitely certain things that we probably will not be able to save, but it is becoming harder and harder to create some of the documents like that that cannot be preserved. And if you look at the way some old movies, as a good example, have been brought back, remastered, digitized, and saved on better medium, we've actually, in certain cases, been able, while we've lost certain things, like some Doctor Who episodes or whatever, in other cases, we've been able to look back and bring back data and improve it. So the idea that there's a chance, like it would take a disaster of global proportions for us to sink back to a Dark Ages or anything similar.
Yeah, you can. Bryce just pulled up Amazon Glacier, and so that's a low-cost, long-term storage thing, so you're not getting this stuff in and out. It's for infrequently accessed data. Your cost on that is it's 0.08, basically 9 cents a year.
0.007 per month.
Or wow. 9 cents a year for a gigabyte. So, you know, that's
Well, and keep in mind,
that's falling.
I'll have to run it by my accountant, but maybe.
To loop back to the theme of artificial intelligence, I feel like that is going to be the biggest. I think right now we're very, you know, interested to see cars driving themselves and a lot of functional mechanical things happen. But I feel like the next wave is going to be artificially intelligent robots that will go through your entire archive of your history and parse it, because we're entering an age where the problem is not archiving it. The problem is filtering it and figuring out what's garbage and what's important.
Well, I certainly have that with my photo albums.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't even look in there much.
There are some allegations about what my 10,000 photos are, and I would say that At most half. There's only so many angles I can capture it at, okay, guys? All right? After a period of time, they all start looking the same. So,
yeah.
You know, I was thinking it would be mostly photos of Elon Musk seen through bushes and security gates.
Why would you say that? That's we will be friends. We will. Now, Elon Musk would be one of those people. I ever saw him, I would not approach him.
So, did you?
It would make it such a weird encounter.
Man, it's almost.
No, Andrew would just Chris Farley show the conversation with Elon Musk. It would just, you know.
Remember when you landed that rocket?
That was good, wasn't it?
It was awesome.
Anyways, can I have your email address, and can we maybe go get a donut and a coffee? I'd like to tell you my ideas about rockets. And
well, I mean, the funny part is I'm friends with, like, I have a lot of my immediate circles for good friends with them. One of my friends is actually an investor in SpaceX, and so I've never ever used that in any capacity, you know, to be like, hey, well, you know, maybe like sometime, you know, we could call Elon and we could.
He's made it very clear publicly he has no interest in getting anywhere near Elon Musk. So if Mr. Musk would be kind enough to drop the restraining order, yes, then we can all just move on.
Well, like, I'll tell you, just as an aside, like, my general policy, like, with celebrities and stuff is, like, I had an awkward 5 minutes with Lawrence Fishburne because I go to this place, Fat Sal's, this great sub shop. He orders, and I didn't realize it's him. He orders, then I order, and we have to stand next to each other at the counter waiting for our food. And I know the last thing this guy wants is to have a conversation with somebody about his work or whatever you're doing. And I'm normally a chatty person. I will talk to anybody. I took a friend with me went to the Martian presentation Fox did with Ridley Scott, Andy Rear. It was really, really great. And this person's like watching me talk to just anybody who sits next to us or whatever, you know, because I'm just, it's like, wow, it's interesting. I'm like, yeah, like, I'll just talk to everybody. But in this situation, I didn't, because, like, I'm like, this guy, last thing this guy wants is a conversation, you know? And so it was just an awkward 5 minutes of just us waiting for our food, and Larry Fishburne's there and I'm there, and it's just like, hey, and then.
Well, it's funny because, like, you think in terms of, you know,
I love you in Avengers. You're so great in Avengers.
Oh, ouch.
I'll tell you who I love the most is 430 of the baddest ass people on the planet who are keeping us loud, live, and independent here with Weird Things. If you go to patreon.com/weirdthings, you could join the ranks of the proud. 430 patrons and counting, creeping up. We're going to hit that 500, and then we're going to build a spaceship, and then we're going to go to the moon and argue about how many robots should be on the moon.
Yeah, you know, and I'm going to hold firm. Under 3. You know, anything more than 3 robots, and now we've got a real problem here, Brian, and I don't want to hear any lip out of you.
Yeah, I look, there's only one way to solve this, and it's space gladiator combats, as will be the new norm on the moon.
Exactly. On the moon, all formerly litigated battles in courts of law will be determined by space jousting. Be sure to get on the front lines when you donate to patreon.com/weirdthings. Thank you to everybody who has done it. It gives us the opportunity to talk to you guys every single week and have amazing guests like JF.
Yeah, and by the way, for the record, we don't care how much you donate. We would just like to see more people cross.
No, we do, Brian.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, if you don't care, I'm going to reduce.
I can't speak for the other guys, but if you ran into us, would you buy us a beer? Take what? 1, 2, 3, 4
no, I'd
beers.
No, I'd be too shy.
$20 a year, nickel an episode. Go for it.
Yeah, nickel an ep, dime for limes.
Hey, did you guys see the news about preserving that rabbit brain?
Mm-hmm.
How big a deal is this? I know that right now you got a lot of people who are just going to hope that when they die, you know, you throw their head in a vat of liquid nitrogen. But of course, the problem is that the water freezes, the crystals, you know, cut and damage, and you get freezer burned mush where brains ought to be. But I didn't read up too much on this. But basically, a rabbit brain was preserved right down to the last neuron. Is that right?
Yeah, there. So what it is, it's a non-destructive way apparently in which to preserve it, where you don't get the violent reaction of the water crystals bursting through the cells and destroying it, and you have to pray for some sort of magical nanotechnology to come along and fix it. So it'll be interesting when we're actually be able to do this with a. Doesn't mean that they were able to restart the brain or get blood flowing through the brain or replace the medium, as far as I know. But it's a step. It's a step.
Yeah, it's an incremental thing, which this is the kind of thing that I think we're going to see maybe medical applications to, maybe not for brains, but how to cryogenically preserve certain organs for organ donation. We're going to see other application beyond pulling a Walt Disney and freezing heads for future use long before that.
Interesting. So, gentlemen, it's time to talk about the life engineered.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't know anything about that.
Hey, okay.
An author by the name of J.F. Dubow, I believe. I'm going to read the back passage here.
Sure, knock yourself out.
Because we only read books if they're read to us by saintly people with angelic voices.
I'm trying to get an audiobook done for it, just mostly because
it's beautiful. This book is beautiful. Now let me first, I'm going to start off with a quote. This is from a Veronico Bielmont and Tomas Merit of a Sword and Laser. I guess they're maybe a musical duo.
Anyhow, they're great. I love them. Follow their SoundCloud.
Tired of stories of humanity fighting against robot overlords? Read one for the robots, a fascinating investigation of whether even creatures we created could avoid our own foibles and fates. In the year 3594, humanity is little more than a memory, a legend of the distant past. The Capex, nice little nod there to RUR, a race of artificial creatures originally created by humans, have inherited the galaxy and formed a utopian civilization built on the shared goal of tirelessly working to prepare for the Remaker's reappearance. For though the human race is the stuff of legend, one thing is certain to the Capex, humanity will return.
So how long was, actually most of my questions really belong in after things, because I want to know about stuff like, you know, how long you sat on the idea, how you developed it, how you wrote it, but we should stick to the content itself there. Have you found yourself, as you enter the promotion phase for your finished artwork, of figuring out what the right elevator pitch is to give to you know, people who maybe aren't naturally inclined to get all fired up about science fiction?
So my background's in graphic design and brands, and I'm a brand specialist, which means that there's a heavy leaning in my training towards marketing. I'm very good at promoting things. I'm skilled and trained into finding good promotional avenues for various products and brands and bringing them to the right market. Except for anything I do where I'm a complete incompetent and a babbling buffoon whenever I try to promote my own stuff. And this goes for whenever I'm trying to do a proper elevator pitch for a book. Because every time I do a Hollywood pitch and I'll say, oh, it's like this movie and that movie with a bit of that, I immediately want to follow it up with maybe 5 to 10 minutes explaining how, no, wait, it goes deeper than that. And I have other books that I've written that I'm sort of working on getting published that have much simpler elevator pitches than this one. This one I haven't been able to really get the 2-sentence pitch. So the
part
the closest
of an elevator
thing
pitch
I can
is,
say
is,
sorry, go
is
ahead.
Tailoring it to your audience. And so what you have written, from what I gather, is something that very much if you like Peter of Hamilton or Ian Banks or you like Werner Vinge and you like the idea of what is this, let's accept AI as a reality and AI as a strong personalities, what is that going to be like? You know, your central protagonist is somebody who's present day or whatever, and then finds himself into this new sort of world. So it seems, if I'm correct, correct me if I'm wrong. So it's a fish out of water and sort of thing. What's that?
You got it. You're on the nose with it.
Okay, so yeah, so we get this sort of part of it is like, what is this world going to be like? And I love the culture novels, but sometimes I just want to spend more time finding out about the culture, you know. And I think that Peter F. Hamilton, some of his best books are just kind of like, tell me more about this world. And I like the idea that it is from a first person point of view of going into this world and seeing what this is like, which sounds, you know, a neat exploration of that. This is increasingly becoming a future that I think a lot of us would love to have happen or curious to see. But what will the conflicts be? And you're looking at addressing that. So my pitch is, like, if you're talking to an audience like sci-fi, like, listen, if you're reading E.M. Banks or Peter F. Hamilton like this, this seems to be that's right in that vein.
Perfect. See, this is exactly why I wanted to be here, so I could get this this kind of consultant point of view towards promoting my book. Like, yeah, last week, last episode, you guys, we were things or after things. I kind of listened to them back to back, so I mixed them a bit. You guys had this very kind of segment, like, pitch us a project so we can help you with it, and I was very tempted to send in something like that, like, how do I promote my dumb book?
Awesome. Is there anything that that you particularly were inspired by when you were writing this book that maybe fans of those novels could find enjoyment in what you wrote?
There's two things that kind of helped mold the book thematically. The Rational Optimist really put me on the track of thinking of the future, the far future, about robots in a more positive light and less in a sort of anti-human or human versus robot, and more what happened, because the idea was basically it put me on a track of imagining a story where humans and robots actually aren't against each other, but how they would evolve in parallel and what would happen, like, try to build a story around that. But the idea of writing a book exclusively about robots came from reading Ilium by Dan Simmons, which doesn't center on robots, but has these two characters on the sidelines that are kind of witnessing events that are artificial intelligence type creatures. And I liked the interaction. I liked the idea that they could be extremely different from what we imagine robots to be, and what because we have a tendency to just think of robots, oh yeah, robots, androids, but you can do so much more. Like, one of the things that put me on that I want to explore is, what if me as a person or anybody was given a chance to build whatever they wanted as and to live the life they wanted? Like, if I wanted to be a marine biologist, what would I do if I could just rebuild my body completely and have all the information I wanted implanted in my mind to be the perfect marine biologist? Like, obviously I wouldn't just be a humanoid individual. Like, I'd be something that has, I don't know, that's built more like a fish, and I'd have all these, I'd have senses that go beyond just sight. I'd have sonar. I'd have a lot more at my disposal. And if you have a race of robots, they would each probably build themselves that way. So it's all these kind of ideas I brought together to create the story. And then I just wrote a murder mystery.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. And we can get into that in after things too, about world building is great, but inherently you need to have something happen in there to show that world. And in doing a story of, you know, a Boston cop who's got to go investigate or try to, you know, go along and in this, it's a great way to, you know, do this. Asimov, you know, did this in the robot stories, the idea of having this, because it's a great mechanism to do that, of asking questions and going into different places and that. So I just, like, I liked Werner Vinge, was it Rainbow's End? What was it?
Rainbow's Edge.
Yeah, Rainbow's, you know, and I loved that, but I kind of, what my criticism of that was waiting a long time for something to happen other than this guy adjusting. That being said, it was a neat sort of, you know, shorter term sort of, you know, intro to that. So I think that seems good. And I like the length of what you did here. I think that's a very cool idea. I have a suggestion, if this is okay, is that,
please.
Did you want to give away a couple books?
I'd like to give away 5 books.
Okay. Do you have a mailing list, or would you rather people go on your mailing list or your Twitter?
I've created a mailing list specifically for this giveaway, which I hope to expand, because I should have a mailing list, and I've been too lazy, maybe stupid, to actually get around to putting one together, mostly relying on the mailing list that's already provided through Inkshares. But I should be like the idea is to expand beyond that. So yeah, I do have a mailing list, and what I would like to do is offer the Weird Things After Things audience a chance to, just by signing up to my mailing list, get a chance to win the book. And what they can do, and don't necessarily tell my publisher, like, if you don't want to stay on the mailing list, just sign up, wait until the drawing.
Right. Get on the mailing list. You don't need to just, whatever they want to do past that, they're grown folks, they can handle it. bit.ly/lifeengineered. Again, that is bit.ly/lifeengineered. Is where you need to go. You sign up for the mailing list, you got a shot to win a free copy of J.F. Dubois' novel, which I think is just a great opportunity and a reward for all the loyal Weird Things listeners.
So how many copies? Are you going to have one copy or two copies? How many do you want to give away here?
5.
5 copies?
Yeah.
All right.
That's what I was told by my publisher I could give away. So
that's what they told us. That's what they told us too. But yes.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
5 copies. I've just signed up for the mailing list in the time that it took us to talk about that. So like Justin said, bit.ly, Life Engineered. Sign up for it. Support it. JF has been listening to this podcast for how long?
I don't know exactly how long, but I'm going to estimate 3 years.
3 years. 3 years. He was a listener to the podcast. He's a person that came to this because he had a lot of the same weird thoughts, same interests, same questions we're asking, part of the community, part we're doing here. And this is a person that decided he wanted to start talking about and expounding upon that, and took that leap, that very big leap, which we're going to talk about coming up in After Things, and put his keyboard where his mouth is, or whatever. He wrote something, put it up there, went through the whole process to say, hey, I want to share something. And I commend you for doing that, sir. And it is exciting to see people who we have a lot in common with, who are part of this community, going out there and expanding outwards and sharing, you know, these things that we're curious about with the rest of the world. So kudos to you, sir.
Thank you. And there's a lot of the one of the things I find is very exciting about the development with Weird Things lately is the addition of the After Things portion. Because one of the things that I really love about the podcast is when you guys start discussing about the sort of the meat and potatoes, the how the sausage is made of your various creative endeavors. And there's a lot of what I'm doing right now, a lot of the successes that I've encountered that I can attribute to things I've learned here. So thanks.
Wow. One person, guys, I knew one day we'd hear it. All right.
Got it.
I'm that guy.
Go ahead, Justin.
I was going to say, do we want to get into picks?
Yeah.
My pick is was actually the official selection of the Sword and Laser podcast. I understand
Asteroid
that it's like Peter
of
Hamilton.
Awesome book. I've read it. Not that one.
All right, no, if you like Peter Pan, if you like that, if you're into sort of the culture novels, what it's like, the idea of a society in the world where the AI have built this sort of world, but what is the role of humanity in there? I highly recommend, I'm told, really, really good from, again, Tomas Morit, The Life Engineered by J.F. Dubois, which you can order directly from Inkshares if you like. Do you get any more money if it comes from Inkshares or versus Amazon?
No, I get the same amount of money. I would rather, if anyone's ordering right now, I'd rather get Amazon orders, because then it goes into like
climbs the Amazon list. Absolutely,
exactly.
Good point. Yeah, let's you know, it's available also, and you can pre-order the Kindle, which I think Kindle version, which I think $5.99, or you can get the paperback version. It's a really well done paperback version, and it comes with pages. There's a glossary which I love, and you get a photo of JF, and I'm holding, by the way, copies 689 to 750, so pretty happy about that. So Engineered.
Hey, man, my pick is the book Leviathan Wakes, upon which The Expanse is based. The Expanse, of course, is a new sci-fi series, and we're covering it and talking about it on the Cord Killers podcast, and I have enjoyed it very, very much. And I enjoyed it enough that as it hit its either end of the season or mid-season break, I know it'll be a while till we get new episodes, I decided to go read the book since I had now seen the show. And man, it's amazing how much of the book really, really effectively got told on the television show. It's way good. And programming note, if you watch Cord Killers, we're going to have the authors, the duo who collectively write under the name James S.A. Corey on Cord Killers tomorrow for a spoiler in time, where I'm sure we'll hear a lot of behind the scenes stuff about how the sausage is made, to watch one of their pieces get turned into television gold.
Amazing.
I'm gonna big Daredevil, not Daredevil, Deadpool, not Daredevil. The other D. Where's the D?
Deadpool?
So Deadpool, man, it's a movie that came out this weekend. Went and saw it, and I really, really dug it. I thought it was, you know, very much a movie for its age. You know, being an R-rated superhero film that effectively is its own super fun story, while kind of living in this half parody world of our superhero film culture. I'm very excited that it did as well as it did. $135 million projected for its opening 4-day weekend. That is $8 million more than Man of Steel did for context. And, you know, that's for an R-rated movie, which, you know, no matter what, everybody kind of always sort of thought, I mean, at least it was studio logic, that if it's a superhero movie, it's at least kind of for kids. And that is dispelled with this one. I thought it was super fun. I had a great time. And considering where they want to go with that franchise, I think that there's a big, bright Deadpool future, which will hopefully include somebody dressing up like Deadpool at a convention. I'm glad to see there'll be more of those.
I'm going to reinforce. I laughed so hard I started wheezing in that movie. It's at 96% audience score on Rotten Tomatoes with 100,000. And when I put my tweet out about it, super enthusiastic. It's raunchy. It's foul-mouthed. It is a hard R, and it earned it very well. They made full use of it. And I love that movie. I was skeptical at the get-go, like, well, you know, the trailers are good, but how good will the movie be? And I heart Deadpool. I saw it with Peter J. Wax, who we'll bring in with After Things to ask some intelligent questions of JF, and we were in tears, pretty much.
What about you, JF? Outside of your own book, what do you recommend? What are you into these days?
This is going to sound weird because I'm a bit behind on things. I've been re-binge watching Venture Brothers, and I'm super enjoying it because it's I like I said, I'm really late on all forms of media. And recently I caught up on Rick and Morty, and I wanted something that had a bit of the same tone. And I remembered Venture Brothers being that kind of thing. And this is what's been keeping me up later than I should at night. I've had an Overwatch, but I don't want to recommend something that people can't go get. But Venture Brothers is easily accessible. I'm sure anybody can find seasons of that. And I hear there's a weak season somewhere, but I haven't reached it, and I'm on season 4. And it's just one of these things that maybe it's in the same – it's probably not in the same vein as Deadpool, but it is kind of foul-mouthed. It is raunchy humor. There are some – very politically incorrect gags in there that feel like they're not afraid to take a left turn where most people would take a right, and I'm just loving it.
Yeah, I went through that same thing after watching Rick and Morty. I'm like, I need more. Let me watch some Futurama. No.
It's too clean. I mean, I love Futurama. Don't get me wrong. I adore it. But
the Netflix ones, the pacing is just so. It's good, but the pacing between jokes and that is just, you know, so spaced out versus Rick and Morty's. It's beat, 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 beat.
Yeah, and it's there's a cruelty to Rick and Morty and Venture Brothers that maybe that says something about me as a person, but that I really enjoy.
Yeah.
There's a sort of darkness to it that just appeals to me.
But like I would say with Rick and Morty, there is a light, but there is the cruelty is the norm, but there is this other thing coming through. It's about the awareness, which is what I loved, is it wasn't like it always reset and everything's cruel, is that there's this bubbling up humanity that comes through it.
Yeah, there's a study of contrast where something absolutely terrible is demonstrated and then used as a foundation to say something profound and beautiful. like that speech that Morty gives Summer about him being dead and buried in the yard and to go watch TV. Man, I love that series.
Anyway. Gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.